Ottawa at midnight. Back to you. When you say did it start off at midnight, what do you mean? Okay, you got a dead watch in front of you with no battery, no display. You plug in a battery, and it starts running. It is indicating incorrect time, but it's indicating some number of hours, some number of minutes, and some number of seconds. What hours, minutes, and seconds does it wake up at when you plug in the battery? Go ahead.
Well, it appears to start running, you know, where it left off. In other words, it's not synced, it's not accurate, but it proceeds to, you know, physically the second hand starts to beat, and, you know, it's keeping time, although it's just wherever it left off. And overnight, it syncs, and when it syncs, it would go perfect. You know, it has servo mechanisms in there, and, you know, within, I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes, or however long it takes for the physical mechanism, you know, to catch up, it would sync to the right time. And I've seen it do that, but it's not doing it now.
Okay, is the watch front face indicator liquid crystal and digital display, or is it analog? What's the nature of the display? Go ahead.
Okay, I thought I'd mention that. This is an analog watch. So it's got a second hand, an hour indicator, an hour hand, and a minute hand. There's no digital function on it at all. Strictly analog.
Okay, I've got a solution for you. There's a way you can fax it. So, when it goes dead, when the battery is dead, let's assume it stopped at 4:31 in the afternoon and 20 seconds. If you wait until 4:31 in the afternoon and then plug in the battery, the hours and the minutes will be accurate. The seconds will be wrong, of course, but overnight, the seconds will be aligned. If you read the instruction manual on battery replacement, I'm going to make a guess. In other words, you don't have a stem you can pull out where you can move the hours and minutes. That's what you seem to be telling me. There's no stem that you can, there's no way you can manually set the time, but you can force it. Don't plug in the battery until that hour is correct. It's equivalent to what happens when your watch goes dead. Oh, my watch is still accurate. It's only accurate twice a day. If you know what I mean. Back to you, Dave.
Okay, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but that doesn't, because the watch, the way these are designed to sync up every night if conditions are good, if propagation is good. Theoretically, you should be able to receive the signal pretty much every night. You might miss it one night or so, you know, depending on maybe you put your watch next to your computer or something like that, and the computer blocks the signal. But theoretically, every night it resyncs, you know, and you get the right time. If it doesn't sync, obviously now you're back on the quartz crystal that's in the watch, and it'll be somewhat accurate, but it's, you know, it's nothing like getting the exact synchronous, you know, setup. So, I'm a little confused. I just, you know, I'm kind of scratching my head like, but how come it's not working now? Somebody else on the frequency has a similar kind of watch, and he said that when he changed his battery, it took like 2 weeks for him to get a sync signal on his watch. So that to me says something about propagation. I was just wondering, is it possible there's some kind of propagation issue going on, and, you know, on that very low frequency that maybe the signals are not that good right now?
K2JJ with a comment.
Mr. JJ, go right ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Vic. Propagation hasn't been good on 60 kilohertz probably since the time change. I would suggest that he's getting a partial code, Dick. That's why the second hand is locking up, but he's not getting the full code. I've had a similar problem here with one of the clocks I have. And I'd suggest he, you know, sets the watch by a window up as high as possible in the house, facing the west, and see if that locks up. It's just a matter of waiting for propagation, I'm afraid. K2JJ back in it.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion, Doug. I'm going to make a guess, Glenn. I mean, Doug. Here we go, Dave. That the portion of the code sent from WWVB. It's easier to get the second portion, more difficult to get the minute portion, more difficult to get the hour portion. That's my guess. The nature of the digital code itself, the rate at which it updates, and so on. That's my guess. So I think you can force it. You've got two choices. Follow Doug's solution, put it in a very desirable place in the house, and wait a week. But I think you can plug in the battery at the right time and get there a hell of a lot faster. And even if the very first week it ends up 2 minutes fast or 2 minutes slow, and a week later it finally corrects that, it's a lot more useful watch by plugging in the battery at the right time. That's the way I would do it. It is possible that at the factory, when it was originally built, that's what they did. Plugged in the battery at exactly the right time. And after that, it easily kept track of the seconds, which is good enough. And the mechanics, once the seconds are accurate, and you start over the right minutes and hours, it never loses minutes and hours until the battery goes dead the first time. I think you said you've read the instructions. You didn't find this carefully putting in the battery at the right time suggestion. And for the people who live near Boulder where they're getting WWVB real strong, they don't have to do this. You and I are in the outback of WWVB. So, I've got two suggestions. Let us know how it turns out. Into APG, K2LAW.
Comment.
Go ahead, Doug.
That's me. It's not Doug. Mark at 2 o'clock.
You got it, Mark.
Okay. Yeah, I was telling Dave earlier on another frequency that I have a Casio, same thing, atomic clock, watch, whatever. And the little satellite image on the watch is always on for the most part. The only time it does go off on occasion, if it's sitting around a lot of metal sometimes. But then I just take it and I put it on the counter, and in an hour or two it's back there. That's fine, so there's no problem here. He's got something strange going on with that watch, Dick.
And there's some possibility that it picked up an electrostatic discharge in the process of him opening up the back and installing the new battery. And maybe it's had a partial failure. Or, then again, my theory is that WWVB sends out the seconds all the time, but only occasionally sends out the minutes and the hours. So you've got to be a little bit more lucky. Whenever I listen to WWV in order 2.5, 5, and 10 megacycles to set my clocks, I have to walk around the house with my little portable receiver, find a spot where I can sort of hear the signal noisily, and the signal is coming in and going out, fading in and fading out. And of course, Mother Nature dictates that just at the time they indicate the real time, they give me the voice announcement, that's when it goes into a fade. But you wait around long enough, you finally get it, and you can set your watches. Yeah. For all we know, on 60KC, that's happening. But I think there's ways you can force it. Anybody with any further suggestions? Give me a tip. Anybody else with any further suggestions? Give me a call that is right now.
K2KY, I'll tell you how to fix it.
Go ahead, Mel.
I just happened to hear the same thing from somebody else. And he spoke to the company, and he told them how to fix it. And I said, what? And he says, yeah. He says, it does fix it. The case of the watch, the metal case, the plate, I believe he says, back plate is metal. And what they told him to do is attach a wire, a length of wire, to the back of the case. In other words, put the wire down, you know, stretch it out, and then lay the back of the case onto it. And he says it will enhance the signal and most likely correct it because of the weak signal conditions right now on 60 kilohertz, Dick. That's the way, I looked at him. I said, sounds kind of far-fetched, but maybe he's not so wrong after all. Over.
I like the sound of that. By the way, Dave, is the cover on the back that you removed to replace the battery, is that cover electronically isolated from the rest of the watch? Is that the antenna, so to speak? Go ahead.
Is that 2APG? No, the antenna is built into the mechanism. They're actually, you can see pictures on the internet of, you know, what these wristwatches look like. They have a, you know, it's a little receiver, a little antenna, and stuff like that in there. And the back of the watch that you take off, the back cover, is actually plastic. It's a very inexpensive light made in China. watch. I would like to hear more from Doug regarding propagation. Doug said conditions on 60 kilohertz have been very poor for a couple of weeks. Could he elaborate on that? Has he been listening down there? Does he, you know, is he operating HF very low frequency? I'd like to know more about that.
K2JJ, you got it.
All right, Doug, very good. Yeah, I'm just going by my my usual habits with these so-called atomic clocks. I have one that's experiencing the same thing as I think it's Dave is getting, whereas the seconds are locking up. However, the you know, the minutes are not quite right. So I have a feeling it's just propagation. Now that's been since the time change back on the second, I guess. Another one I have, which has that particular one that's having the problem, has a built-in antenna. The one that's locking up fine has a external ferrite loop type antenna. That one's locking on fine. So you know, it looks like I'm getting a partial code. And you know, once I stop being lazy, I'll move it to the appropriate window, which seems to be a sweet spot here in this house, Dick, for getting WWVB. But things haven't been good. But just as an aside, there is some talk. Let me drop. Okay, looking for a beep. There is some talk lately that they are going to build another transmitter site down in North Carolina to better serve the East Coast. So let's hope the funding comes through for that. There's so much now. There's been a lot of improving the signal quality. But I think that's what it is. He's getting a partial code, not the whole thing. So it's a matter of finding a good spot in the house, Dick. That's been my experience. The one with the external ferrite loop seems to be much better. Dick, back to you, K2JJ.
Yeah, if I were you, Dave, I would put a piece of wire under the watch and lay it on the wooden sill of the window that faces to the west, that's in the highest part of your house. So you got three possible solutions, and let's see which one works. You got it, Dave.
Okay, very good. Well, I want to thank Doug and Mel for their input. It kind of cinches it for me that it's just as Doug said, it's some sort of a propagation receiving issue. You know, I'm thinking that I'm doing something wrong, there's something wrong with the watch, yada, yada, yada. And if he's having a similar problem, somebody else is having a similar problem, I'm having the problem. I think, you know, that's what it is, that it's not the watches. It has more to do with the signal not being received properly. So, okay, very good. Thank you all. I appreciate it. I'll let you know. And incidentally, these watches are amazing. They're down to under $20. And for astronomical purposes, you know, when you want to go out there and see the space shuttle as it comes by and iridium flare satellites, you want to have the right time to impress your friends and stuff. So, very cool. Thanks a lot. We'll continue to listen out. N2APG.
Yeah, you told us the price. They're getting down to $20. What brand name and where did you buy it, Dave?
This one actually doesn't have a brand name on it. It's pretty much a no-name watch. The only thing it says on it, on the face, it says on time, and then it says atomic. On time, atomic. It's very clean looking. It looks like your old Timex watch. You know, it's very nice looking, handsome, clean, white faced watch with the numbers on it. And with shipping to my door on eBay, it was under $20.
Wow, impressive. Anyone else with any questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW.
KC2KXK, Keith.
KC2KXK. Go right ahead, Keith.
Hey, Dick. Good evening. I just got a quick question for you. I got a 102-foot G5RP dipole, about 35 feet up off the ground. The dipole from the front yard to the backyard is perfectly level, but the ground plane underneath it isn't. It drops about halfway across, drops down about a good 12 feet. Does that affect the reflection of the transmission of that dipole? Like, does it degrade the quality of the signal that I'm putting out? I was just curious about that.
I think the answer is yes, but I think the effect is minor. If you talk about the tilt of the ground or the tilt of the ground plane that you're talking about, the Earth underneath it is what I think you're mentioning, and if you calculate how many wavelengths of change of altitude at each of your operating frequencies, I think it's not great. It's going to affect the impedance a little bit, but your antenna tuner takes care of that. It's going to affect the pattern that you radiate into space very slightly. However, the exact pattern you radiate into space, there's only one part of it that's really important to you. How low is that elevation angle? The closer you can get the major elevation angle on the horizon, the better you're going to work DX. And unfortunately, horizontal polarized antennas, don't do that very well unless the antenna has a good number of wavelengths in the ground, above the ground, which is hard for us, most of us to do. Vertical polarization almost doesn't have that problem. The ground reflection from a vertically polarized signal does not experience reversal, therefore you tend not to get a null on the horizon. Now, regardless of what antenna pattern you've got there, Keith, it's got a certain angle of radiation and elevation, it's got a certain polarization, and when it reflects from the ionosphere, that signal is being twisted in polarization all kinds of ways. So you may launch a beautiful horizontal signal from your hometown, and by the time it gets to London, it has twisted through the ionosphere a couple of times in polarization, and it arrives there vertical. And some of the fading that you experience when you're having a CUSA with your buddy in London is because that polarization is rotating, and sometimes it's favorable for one or the other and not at other times. And Faraday polarization rotation, which is a plasma media like the ionosphere, plus the magnetic field, like the Earth's magnetic field, that phenomena, Faraday rotation, does not obey reciprocity. You launch horizontal, today at this hour, he may get vertical. He launches vertical, and you may get vertical. It doesn't reverse in the other direction the same way. So what the ionosphere is doing is 98% of what you see. The exact sloping of the ground or other objects under your antenna.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The other sloping and whatever going on under your antenna is minor by comparison, in my opinion. Back to you, Keith.
Okay. Oh, very good. Yeah, so, basically, you can control your signal as it leaves your property, but you don't have control of any of the other variables, so... So basically, don't fret over it. Okay. Yeah, I'm about 35 feet off the ground. I got the dipole, and if I really wanted to try to thread it through another tree, I could probably get it up around 55, 60 feet. But I don't know if that extra 15 feet would make that much of a difference.
XWS2N.
Paul recognized, and I forgot about you, Paul. Yes, it's worth the try. Also, even though you're happy with your horizontal, consider putting up a vertical dipole, too, and flipping back before, between the two and find out which one fades when and which gives you the best DX today to that particular location. Because this ionosphere is doing all kinds of things to your polarization. You're ahead of the game if you put up more than one polarized antenna. See what Paul's got to say, WS2N, on this subject or space, whichever, K2LIW.
Oh, no, this subject is very good. The dipoles, I have a 12-foot rise, from the backyard to the front yard, and I run them, 20 meters and 80 meters for years, and then for a while, 15 meters, all dipoles, and then I wanted to get Japan, the shortest distance is over the poles, so I ran the antennas at 90 degrees in relation to where they were without the hill. in the backyard, and, you know, we're flush. And, yeah, well, SWR on the radio, anyway, looking at that, I couldn't tell the difference. Worked into Japan, no problem. Worked into Russia, no problem doing that. I just didn't notice any difference. Naturally, I couldn't take an AP test. I couldn't go out there and the next hour work the same, you know, same thing and try to see if there's a big difference on the SWR. But, you know, from day to day, or month to month, even from year to year, because I ran that for years like that, one way, and then years like that, another way, and now they're back again going up the hill. Just never noticed any kind of difference at all, Dick. Back to you. And I'll give you the space report anytime you like.
That's good to know, Paul. I didn't think it would make a big difference, particularly if you calculate how many wavelengths of rise of your dirt. 20 meters is a 60-foot wavelength, and your dirt is changing altitude by 12 feet in your case. That's kind of minor. It's making a little bit of difference of your three-dimensional pattern in space, but the ionosphere really dominates. And for a guy of your resources, Paul, you can set up one dipole up the hill, another one down the hill, two separate feed lines, and flip back and forth between the two. Put up another one that's vertical to complement the ones you got a horizontal. So, tell us what NASA is doing, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, one time, also one comment on the trees, I made a 20-meter beam just with a, you know, just a two-element beam. I had one active dipole, and then I ran a yellow line in the trees, you know, not hooked to anything, you know, just as a reflector. And again, I couldn't tell the distance. I'd have to sort of go down there, rip it out, and then put it back up again. You know, I just can't do that quick to get a good report, Dick. So I just wanted to comment on that. Back to you, and then I'll give you a space report, WS.
Okay.
I got an answer for him.
Go ahead, Mel.
I guess we're not going to get the beat. I would say for him to use a 8JK configuration. Try that, and then you will be able to see whether or not the difference is. Because with the 8JK configuration, you could actually reverse it, make the director, the so-called director, the reflector, and so on and so forth, take over.
Yeah, how do you actually do that flipping? Is it done by a remotely controlled relay, Mel? Go ahead.
Roger. You use a simple relay that will switch the phase up there right at the point. And, of course, HAK, his beam, his system, was really designed for the so-called poor man's beam type, Yagi type of configuration, because most of the early ones were made of just wire and bamboo. Over.
Okay. So, pass it back to you, Paul, to make comment on that and tell us what's going on, what NASA is doing. And unfortunately, we had kind of overcast during that launch, so I guess nobody around here saw the launch. KQLIW.
Okay. I just wonder from Mel, how does it reverse the length of it? I made my reflector, they always say, about 5% longer. So if you're reversing one, you know, making the reflector the director and vice versa, yet, is it, how do they compensate for that? Now your reflector set up in a beam configuration would be shorter, Mel.
No, not necessary. Not necessary that this is a misnomer that, you know, the design of a Yagi about the reflector having to be the longest element. Dick, you want to elaborate on that? Over.
Yeah, when it comes to the so-called WHAK, which really is a two-element end-fire antenna, it is not a pure Yagi. Depending on the phasing of which one you feed first and second, determines whether it fires forward or reverse. So it is an end-fired, all-fed array. It really is two dipoles parallel to each other, both level with reference to the ground, both at the same altitude, and one dipole is ahead of the other. So I've got one dipole that's further north and one dipole that's further south. And if phasing-wise, I feed the south dipole first and the second dipole later, 90 degrees delayed because of the feed lines. It will fire north. And if I reverse the phasing of those two dipoles, it'll fire to the south. So it's not a pure Yagi. It's an all-fed, not a collinear, it's an all-fed, end-fire, directive antenna. So you may be confusing the W8JK with a Yagi. I hope I'm talking about the right antenna. I better turn it back to Mel for a correction on this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. That's it. The 8JK is not really a classic Yagi Olga. However, I'm trying to remember really what the specs were on the 8JK system as far as basically the design. If it's, I guess, what is the really the gain on that antenna over isotropic, Dick? Over.
QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Waiting for a tone.
You're not going to get one. Just go.
Yeah, just a quick thing that I was mentioning, too, is that just a quick rule of thumb about the last length on the Aggie being the largest. Just as a rule of thumb kind of a thing, if you have multiple band antennas on one boom, you can have antennas, like I have one antenna that's got 2 meters and 440, and they're right in between each other on the same boom, and one doesn't see the other one there, and they're both vertically polarized, and one's on 2 meters and 440, and the elements are coinciding right in between the other ones, and one doesn't see the other because they're more than 5% apart. KC2QIQ.
That's one way of looking at it. Also, whenever you have a collinear array, a phased array, an end-fire array where they're all fed, one of the things that's hard to believe is that an antenna, when you're feeding multiple elements, will always fire in the direction of the delay. If your northern dipole is being fed delayed compared to your southern dipole, you will fire to the north. If your southern dipole is fed delayed compared to the northern dipole, you'll fire to the south. As long as we're talking about quarter wavelength delay of a delay and not three-quarter wavelengths of delay, all multi-element antennas fire in the direction of delay. If you got a pure vertical collinear, like a superstation master, and because you're using it off frequency, like going high in frequency, and you're feeding it at the bottom, therefore the elements at the top are getting a delayed signal, because you're up in frequency where the wavelengths are shorter, the whole pattern will tilt in elevation upward. And by the same token, you take a superstation master and feed it at a lower frequency than it's designed, its pancake pattern will tilt down below the horizon. So, whether it's collinear or end fire, antennas fire in the direction of delay, and the HJK uses that as a selectable direction antenna. Set it up so that the dipoles are running east-west, and you can select a northern direction of output signal or a southern direction of output signal. I'm back to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. But I guess the original question they had was the ground, whether or not that changed the SWR. And, is that really a... I never noticed this difference, but the beams, okay, I got you. You're really not running a true Yagi. Running things out of phase. Sounds good, Mel. Very good. Dick, should we go on with the space report? This is WS.
Fire when ready.
Okay, well, I guess we'll start from the furthest away from Earth and work our way back. There's a discovery of, and with pictures of a couple of planets going around a star on the constellation Pegasus. This was photographed by a couple of telescopes in Hawaii, Gemini and the Keck. They used the Keck as a big, I think, 36 mirrors all linked together. to form one gigantic telescope. And they've now got actual pictures of two or three planets, probably Jupiter size or bigger, going around the star. So I thought that was pretty cool. I thought I'd bring that up, Dick. Hubble, they said, found one too a while back. But this is the first time they've got a solar system photographed. They're working a lot way back to Earth. We've got the Cassini is doing well, going around Saturn, and of course the two Mars rovers, Opportunity and Spirit, up to almost 5 years now, still driving around on that planet, sending back new science all the time. A lot of times they get stuck in the sand and they dig their way out. They get into craters and they do experiments and then they leave. 5 years of endeavor and opportunity. I thought that's amazing for something that was, they would have been happy for the last three months. Talking about spacecraft lasting 3 months, that's what they thought the Phoenix spacecraft was going to last. It turned out to be 6 months. And that's the one that landed the northern part of Mars. It was not a rover. It landed a three-legged craft and dug it to the surface, tested for water, found it, and ran a lot of different chemical tests with that spacecraft. And that had the laser shooting into the sky, investigating the atmosphere, while Mars...
Repeater, time out.
Exercise equipment, food, water, everything you need to supply a station to permanently keep six people on board instead of three. Since the beginning, the most they ever had was three. You're bringing in new beds and toilets and you name it. Four EVAs during this mission. Main work will be on the solar alpha ray joints, big joints as big as a car on each side of the station. This station, there's these truss station that's holding everything together. It's a couple hundred feet. And on the ends, they have these gigantic joints which rotate on the starboard side and the port side. Two 240-foot solar panels which supply the station with the power. 15-day mission. Let me drop it. The 15-day mission, it's an extended mission. They'll probably make it even 16 days. And they could stay a lot longer. Years ago, they would never stay, they'd stay a week or 10 days, but now they can go on and on because they have an adapter which takes the power, sucks the power from the big solar panels on the space station and supplies the Endeavour with extra power, and it allows them to stay even longer. So, and if they could stay up there probably a month or so with the capability if they had to, if they had any kind of damage. And the EVAs are going to change out everything, including nitrogen tanks. They're going to put in new antennas on a Kaibo unit, big Japanese module that was brought up last year. Living quarters, for, gigantic layup. They're going to do that, and they're going to bring up equipment to get ready for the new S6 truss section, which would be the solar arrays, the final solar arrays that will be mounted on there. And they're going to be lubricating the joints on the solar alpha ray joints with some kind of special grease that they're bringing up. That you might know they had problems with it a year or so ago when they were drawing high amperage and they noticed there's problems in chafing and like little metal filings here and there. And it's supposed to compensate for that to extend the life of these gigantic joints which rotate the solar arrays to match the sun, every time they go around the Earth, constantly turning. So that's roughly it, Dick. Hope I made it this time. This is WS2M.
Yeah, beautiful. You made it this time. I've got a question here, Paul, and that is, when they're... Like now, I think it's Endeavour that's at the International Space Station. They're plugged into the space station and therefore drawing power from those new great big solar arrays. Therefore, they don't have to use the consumables on the shuttle as fast. Therefore, they can stay longer. Ordinarily, if I understand correctly, your oxygen tanks are used to supply oxygen to the fuel cells. They, in turn, give you electricity. So now you don't have to consume the oxygen to the fuel cells to generate electricity when you're getting it from the solar cells of the International Space Station. However, when you do that, aren't you turning off a fuel cell? And in the past, maybe they've redesigned the fuel cells, in the past, once you turn off a fuel cell, you might not be able to turn it back on. Maybe you got some clarity on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, I don't know if they have to. Do they have to run those fuel cells full blast? Can they cut back on this? I don't know. I know there's plenty of water generated from these fuel cells. They're always dumping the water dumps into space. But of course, they're also using the water. The I don't know, Dick. What's better, using up your oxygen and hydrogen, whatever they're gonna to make the fuel to make the electricity, or you think they're shutting it down and then they got to restart them? I don't know. I would think they probably let them go. Maybe they could run them at a lower level, Dick. Maybe they don't shut them off.
I think you got the right answer. If you completely shut them off, maybe you can't restart them. But if you just turn them down to a low level or keep voltage applied to the output from the space station, then maybe there's no problem. And yes, you're right. They're using oxygen and hydrogen down here on Earth, all we have to do is supply the, I guess the hydrogen, the air will supply the oxygen automatically for the fuel cells we got on Earth. So I guess you're saying they could stay a very long time once they're using the power from the International Space Station. I think you're saying they're going to stay 16 days, but they could stay beyond that if they wanted to. Is that what you said, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Now the plans, every time these shuttles go up, like you've got a plant that's waiting, if they found out that there's any kind of damage, by the way, there was a little damage in the port near the Olmsted engine, some kind of material came off, but it's not a critical area. But they investigate these things when they get up to the space before they even attach the space station to check. Since the Columbia disaster, they've got a 50-foot boom, then another 50-foot boom on top of that, 100-foot boom, lasers and cameras, and then they check everything out. So, but I mean, let's say there was a damaged tile or a carbon-carbon piece like what happened to Columbia, and here's a hole in the wing. Yeah, they can attach to the space station and sit there and wait for the rescue craft, whichever one is designed to go, and which could take a month to launch. So they have that capability there.
Now, when you have an extended stay, and I think 7 astronauts went up this time, and you have an extended stay at the space station, aren't you consuming the consumables more rapidly, using up the water, oxygen, food, and whatever? And all of that's got to be brought up periodically with the Tegra spaceships. So that's one reason why you wouldn't want to dwell a long time. All these people are using up all the consumables. I wonder if they mentioned that, Paul. Go ahead.
For instance, now they're bringing up enough stuff for 6 people to stay up permanently. So, for at least 6 months at a time. So you've got 3 on a regular basis now. Now you'll have 6. So the equivalent of, instead of like having 7 astronauts up, it's like bringing 4 up that you'd have to really be concerned about. They bring up more food than you can imagine, and they can last up to 6 months. And if they got into a jam, and if they decide, well, we're bored, we're going to eat a real lot, and they needed more food, they can get rushed to launch a Progress ship up, which is an unmanned cargo craft, or they could even, I think there's supposed to be another ATV launched from French Guiana down in South America by the European Space Agency, another one of these things which bring up 3 or 4 times the amount that a Progress ship is capable of. They're going to have more stuff up there than they know what to do with. I mean, they're bringing up more stoves. Everything went up this time, Dick. I think they could stay a long time, and might be a little cramped, but they've got sleeping quarters in the shuttle. They've got plenty of room now in the International Space Station. More room than they know what to do with, I think. And I don't think they would have a problem. And the shuttle is capable of bringing people up. At one time, I remember they used to bring up 11 astronauts in some of these missions, before the space station back here.
Wow, I don't remember that. That a space shuttle launch took place with 11 astronauts on board? Wow. I thought 7 was the maximum we ever launched. Now, give me a little bit of a head count here in 2 areas. Number one, I think for most of the previous years, only 2 astronauts remained on the International Space Station. Now, because of all the extra room and hardware and whatever, I have the impression that at the end of this particular Endeavour mission, tell us how many will be on board. In the future, how many will be on board. And if you have to use Soyuz as a safety return, what's the maximum number of people it can take back down? Back to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah, flight rules are you need whatever the amount of people are up there, you need the amount of seats to get back down. That's the rules. What they're going to do is have two Soyuz craft to dock to this thing. So they'll be able to leave like that. so that takes care of that problem. In the beginning, there were two. I remember this guy, Shepard, not Alan Shepard, another guy, Shepard. He was the first commander up there. Was a Russian. And they had two for quite a while in the beginning. And then it went to a permanent three-person crew. And that lasted, I don't know, a couple of years, probably 2 years, I guess, probably a year and a half, almost 2 years before the Columbia crash. So they had a perfect, two to three, and then because of that, they weren't going to be sending any more shuttles up for quite a while, just Progress ships and Soyuz ships. They dropped it down to two, and then recently, what, a year or so ago, a year or two, they now run three-person crews on a regular basis. When Endeavour leaves, it will still be three. It's not planned to have six on board until 2009, probably after the last solar arrays are attached, and then you'll have a permanent crew of six. Originally planned was seven, I think, the original plan when the space station was designed. We drop it. After 2010, I think nine more flights, won't have any more shuttles, and you just have the Soyuz returning to the space station until at least 4 or 5 years from 2010, probably 2014, 2015, when the Orion constellation missions come online in the United States and start bringing our own astronauts back up there. Back here.
Do you have a guess, Paul, that our shuttle may very well be extended because to have a 5 or 6 year gap before our Orion comes on board, it seems to me like we're abandoning the shuttle prematurely. What do you think?
They were built for 25 years service. So they came in 1981. They came online with Columbia. So, you know, time is running out. I mean, they were built for 100 missions each. That was the design qualification for it. Problem is, they thought they were going to be going up every 2 weeks initially, but that didn't happen. So the time is running out, 25-year deal. I mean, they've done plenty of modifications and upgrades over the years, but that's, you know, it's become a deal where they really want to go on to, you know, lunar exploration, eventually on to Mars. So, you know, let's get on with it and do away with the shuttle. Shuttle can't go to the moon, can't go to Mars. So let's build something that can. Something that can also go to the space station and retire the shuttle. The shuttle's dangerous. A lot of people think that it does have its problems. Too complicated, too expensive, much less expensive to run the Orion program for the same people and the same much more weight that you can bring up with this whole constellation system. And you'll be able to get more for less. That always
went down. One last question. Does Orion have a lander craft somewhat like the shuttle?
No, the shuttle design is going to be completely gone. Orion is, they call it the constellation system. It consists of two different types of launches. One, the manned lamp launcher, which is basically a solid booster rocket with a second stage on top. That'll put your crew into orbit, carrying up to six people per shot. If you want to go to the moon, it'll be four people. Then you have your cargo launcher, which is the equivalent of taking an external tank that they put on the shuttle, and on top of that, putting you can look on the internet the picture of it, but it's going to be a cargo launcher, so it's basically like the shuttle that's unmanned, except it's going to look like a typical rocket, you know, without wings or anything. And that will have bigger lift, the equivalent lift of the Saturn V. So bigger payloads. And let me drop it. Returning is going to be similar to the Apollo. You come in from the moon at 25,000 miles an hour, come in orbit at 17,500. Heat shield, difference is they're going to land on the ground. They're not going to land in the water. You know, they're going to have parachutes come out. And they will be reusable up to 10 times. It's not a throwaway craft. The Apollo came back and they sent up a new Apollo. And then, you know, they didn't send up the exact same one anymore. I mean, when I came back, that was it. Went off to a museum somewhere. These things won't until their 10th mission. Back to you, Dick.
KC2 QIQ.
Glenn, recognize. The rest of the launch vehicle is all not recoverable, Paul?
The solids are. I think they're going to come back and land in the water. That's recoverable. Just like the shuttle. They're up to 20 uses per solid.
Okay, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, hi, Dick. From some of the stuff I've read about Orion, do you see that the diameter of the command part of the spacecraft is going to be 5 times the diameter of Apollo's and be able to carry something like 2.5 times the volume of things into space as Apollo did in the command module?
Nice to know. But still, there's going to be this uncomfortable gap between shuttle discontinue and Orion continue, and will be thoroughly dependent on Soyuz during that period of time. No real backup, so to speak. Okay. Hi, Mel. I think we should probably go to the mailbag. Bet you've had some interesting mail this week. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, very interesting about the shuttle and all, what's going to be with it. Yeah, when they have to replace it. I think that maybe, I could say, going to run it a little longer than they expected. As far as, let's see. First of all, I just dug up the 8JK two-element Enfire array that John Krause described in 1940 to the IRE. I had that proceeding. I saw it in my file, and I wanted to take a look at it. Very interesting, Dick. You know, he had exactly 6 variations on the same antenna, and he described, a number of the reasons that he went to these different configurations, and what he called a flat top B, Dick, over.
Yep, flat top, two element, all fed. I call it an Enfire array, where, depending on how you flip the relay, whether you fed the forward end of the twin lead, so to speak, or the back end of the twin lead, you made it fire backwards or forward. Go ahead.
Roger, yes, and he shows you here that through a lot of very interesting mathematics and drawings, that with a 1/8 spacing, 11 ohms heat, and with a 33 quarter inch spacing, quarter wavelength spacing, I should say, quarter wave from instead of an eighth wave spacing, 33 ohms, and claim is 3.3 dB over a dipole deck over.
So 3.3 over dipole is therefore 5.5 over isotropic. Fairly nice antenna. That's a lot of gain out of two elements. I'm able to get a little bit over 6 dB over isotropic out of a three-element Yagi, but I can't select the direction. So 5.5 over iso for two elements. Sounds good. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. Very little known about, the antenna because it sort of disappeared. It was popular for a while, I guess, with amateur radio right after World War II. And then, of course, the aluminum antennas, the regular Yagi, came into being. And
more or less the type of design of John Krauss disappeared. But it's real interesting to see the different ways he bent and twisted the system to get different effects. And I guess there most likely would be applications somewhat today, but I guess now you won't see very much of it. All right, shall we go on?
I think we should. Go right ahead to your mailbag if you want to.
Okay, well, you know, a question that's come up here quite a bit, let me see, I'm looking through here, whatever I can possibly bring up here, and I'm looking for ones that seems like a number of people have asked, and there seems to be a lot of confusion. They said that they do not understand a term that you used a few weeks ago, what is a joule, J-O-U-L-E. So please try to explain a joule a little bit more simply than getting into high technical information about how a joule, why do we use a joule? And, oh boy, I see about four questions like this from the same group, Dick, over.
Okay, and we're now getting into power and energy. When it comes to power, most of us have got a gut feel for knowing what is a horsepower. The engine on my car might have 150 horsepower. And in theory, it can do as much work as a 150 horse team, in theory. So, horsepower, the rate at which work can be done. No, I did not say that. Yes, I can. You could say a horse does work at a certain rate. Two horses can do twice as much work in the same period of time. So horsepower, we know what that means. Wattage, we know what that means. We have a gut feel for what is a 100-watt light bulb and a 60-watt light bulb. Again, that's a unit of power. 746 watts happens to be the same amount of power as one horsepower. So if I have a 746-watt engine, electric motor, that runs at 100% efficiency, in theory it can generate one horsepower of mechanical energy when I put 746 watts into it. When it comes to watts for a period of time, that meter outside your house measures watt hours. If I run a kilowatt element on my electric stove and I run it for 1 hour, that meter outside my house is going to register 1 kilowatt hour. And by the time I add all of the fees and taxes and everything else, fuel allowances, I'm probably paying something like 17 cents for each kilowatt hour on that watt hour meter. Watt hour is a certain amount of power, a kilowatt for instance, for a certain length of time, 1 hour, or 360 seconds, watt times time is energy. A watt hour is a unit of energy. A watt is a rate of doing work, but energy is the total amount of work you've done, you could say. Total amount of work you've done. So a watt hour...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A watt hour, we have a feeling for that. And these are the convenient English units. When it comes to the scientific units, all of a sudden we get into a bunch of units that we're not as familiar with. Newton meter, Newton, and joule. A Newton is around a quarter of a pound. A unit is a unit of force. About a quarter of a pound is a Newton. That's a crazy unit. Why would we use it? Well, if you have a Newton of force, and if it pushes some resisting object through a distance of 1 meter, you have expended an amount of energy that's called 1 joule. If I was real smart, I would know what is the conversion between watt hours and joules, but we can look that one up. So a certain number of watt hours equals a joule. So joule and watt hour are the same thing. They're just a unit of slightly different size. One is more scientific, the joule, and the watt hour is the more popular one we use here in the States. Horsepower, remember I told you it's got 746 watts per horsepower.